and would give more fodder for advocates of, you know, labor advocates in the United States to lawmakers to force them to do so, because it proved that legislation is what forced their hand in the EU. So the similar approach would surely work in the United States. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. We will obviously keep an eye on this and see what happens moving forward with Uber in the EU. And we will bring that back to you as that story develops. But thank you so much for tuning in to Labor Radio. We will be back with you next month. And again, I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a great evening.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We have a very special guest here tonight. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Kerry Robinson. I'm an inmate here on North Carolina's death row, and I've been here for 21 years now. I was convicted in 2000 for the murder of a restaurant manager in a town called Wilson, North Carolina. I'm 48 years old. I just had a birthday Thursday, December the 9th, so happy belated birthday to myself. I have 3 kids and a handful of grandkids, and I'm very family-oriented, so I love my family dearly. I try to talk to them as much as possible.
Oh, thank you. And can you tell me a little bit more about, so you've got three kids and you've got some grandkids and you're from North Carolina. So what was your life like prior to being arrested? Let's go back there first. Let's go back into some of your earlier life first. Can you tell us a little bit about your life before you were arrested?
So I came up in the low-income housing community in Wilson, and I guess the dynamic then, certainly the demographic, was that it was for single parent mothers, you know, and the elder generation. So there was a lot of senior citizens in our neighborhood, and there was also a lot of single parents who had kids. That was almost a requirement that you had to have kids. And I'm not sure, it certainly wasn't the time before gentrification, but it certainly was before the gentrification in our community, in our district. It's like the first housing project that was set on the outskirts of town. So we was kind of away from the inner city, away from the public eye. There wasn't truancy officers or police riding through our neighborhoods. And because of our situation with the single parents, it made for a group of really unruly kids. You know, so when I came up, we just did a lot in the way of vandalism, a lot of mischievous things like stealing, ducking school, smoking cigarettes. I started smoking cigarettes and marijuana really young. I had sex really young. In fact, I had sex when I was 15, and I had my daughter, the girl that I had my daughter when she was pregnant. And I didn't even know how to tell my mom, so I just let my mom find out. So I came up in a community that was really dysfunctional, really. There wasn't a lot of parental guidance. There was no community centers, those things in the neighborhood. And it just kind of really made for a mischievous childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where in North Carolina did you grow up?
In Wilson, North Carolina. And I grew up there all my life.
Yeah. How big is Wilson? Like, do you know the population? Is it small?
Yeah, so it's really, really small. At one time, it was in the 60,000. But I'm sure it wasn't as rich. I think the last census that I've seen was over 100,000. So, but it's still pretty small. Southern town.
Was your community segregated?
It was. There was only one white family that lived behind our projects, and their land was owned. And it was like the first, well, it was kind of friends with all of us, guy Jeff, but he's like the first white guy that I'd known ever in. He didn't have any other kids to play with but us, you know. So everyone in the project were African Americans, and the only thing we had, like, there was no Latino community, there was no Latino families, no Hispanic families, just mostly all black.
Mm-hmm. And what about your parents, your mother or your father? Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Sure. So my mom, my dad was a worker, so he worked all of his life. I think he just came up in a different era than the father that I would have, the father that I wish I would have had, or that I was kind of always had this idea of how a father would be. My dad came up in the 50s and the 60s, you know, and back then fathers kind of worked to provide for their household and their kids. And they kind of went out and really, as long as they brought in the money, they kind of went out and did what they had their extracurricular activity. I just say, you know, mm-hmm. they kind of did what they did, as long as they took care of home.
Yeah.
My mom, so she and him, they struggled for some years. I don't remember my dad as a kid because he was out of the household by the time I was two. And then by then, the situation with him, my mom, was just that he would come around every now and then. He would, by word of mouth, he would certainly express how much he loved my brother and I, but he wasn't around as much. And my mom, she kind of took on odd jobs. But her dynamic with my brother and I was just totally different from my dad. But my dad would say he loved us more than anything. My mom showed, you know, and she kind of worked hard. She worked, I mean, when I say odd jobs, there were times I remember I was 6 or 7 years old, too young to work on my own, but my mom didn't have a babysitter. So she would take us out to, like, the tobacco field. We would sit in the barn and play while she worked. So it was just anything she could to turn a buck. And then I saw, maybe not so much when I was a kid, but certainly now I look back and I saw the sacrifices that went with that. She always made sure my brother had toys and there was always food in the refrigerator. We always had a clean house and warm house. And even if there were times when my mom wasn't so warm herself, she made sure my brother and I and my sister stayed and had all this, the necessities in life that, that she could provide. So
yeah.
The difference between my mom and my dad is that she was around a lot. He did things for us coming up, but he just wasn't around as much.
Yeah. And you said you had brothers?
I have one brother, an older brother, and a younger sister.
Oh, cool.
Called Nebe.
Oh, neat. How is your relationship with your brother and your sister now as an adult?
Well, when I was young, I idolized my brother. He was my worry. He was my rock. Like, I thought he was the one I looked to figure out how to be, because he was only 2 years older than me, so I figured he was the person I would grow into. So I just adored him. I followed everywhere he went. Then I guess when he got a certain age, about 13 or 14, then he started, I guess he was going through adolescence itself, you know, trying to figure out the world and his place in the world. So he certainly wasn't equipped to be a father figure. And I didn't realize it then, but I clung on to him as if he was my father because he filled that void. And maybe it was just he wasn't ready for that. So he started trying to push me off, you know. He would duck me and kind of neglect me. And at some point, he was just abandoning me altogether. So me and my brother, we have a cordial relationship. There's a lot of things that need to be said that in our older self that we don't quite say. Some childhood issues that are still there. But we do have one time we were like a tag team best friend, but I think now that we're older, there's some issues that I still deal with that he was, that was influenced by him, and
yeah.
We just haven't addressed, but we don't talk as much. And my sister, she came up in the same household as my brother and I, of course, but it was a different circumstance with her. My mom, by the time she had my sister, she wanted to be more independent. She wanted to teach her independence. She wanted to give all of us a better life, so she kind of moved out of the house. She didn't move out of the household, but she started school, and she worked sometimes two jobs, and it took her out of the household. There wasn't that maternal attention there that I was used to. Because I was used to coming home, my mom was there to greet me at the door. There's always food on the table. Now I became a latchkey kid. You know, when I would come home, my mom wasn't there. And so my sister came up a little more independent than my brother and I. She isn't as clingy to my mom. She isn't as dependent on my mom as my brother and I were. So as adults, we do talk, my sister and I, but I guess my perspective on my relationship with my brother and sister is that we were a lot closer when we were kids.
Yeah. And is your mother still alive?
She is. She lives in Wilson. In fact, I just called her before I called you guys.
Oh, cool. That's great. Well, it's great that you're still in touch with your mother. Now, I'd like to move around a little bit in your life story, if it's okay. And again, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. So we're talking tonight with Terry Robinson. Terry's been on death row in North Carolina for over 20 years for a crime that he didn't commit. And this is one of a two-part interview that we're doing here on KBOO with Terry about what it's like living on death row, the injustices surrounding his circumstance, and, you know, hopefully maybe a way forward. Terry, let's get to how you ended up on death row. Can you tell us a little bit about the crime that you were accused of and how you were arrested and prosecuted for it?
Sure. So first I want to say that as of lately, especially in the last month or so, there have been some things that have been unfolding, and hopefully for the best, some legal circumstances, and it kind of really know what to say and what not to say, how much I can say, how much I can't say. So I do want to say that if there is areas in the case where I feel really general, it's because I'm not sure the things I can say. But I certainly want to discuss with the viewers and the listeners how a person can end up on death row and be innocent, be falsely accused. And so for me, it was just that. I mean, I was falsely accused by a guy who I was really close with. He was a friend of mine. That was someone I never would have thought would do something like that. I'm not even sure of his...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
But I do know that there was an admission on his part, and he, from his point of view, from his version, I was not only with him, but I was the trigger man. I was the shooter. But there were some other circumstantial things that took place, but from there, I was charged. And 11 months later, I found myself going to trial, and it started this snowball effect. You know, it's like things were just kind of happening, and I was just kind of disassociated with myself.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Phyllis, yeah, we only have 30 seconds. Let me call you back and reiterate the question.
Yeah, sure. I'll be happy to do that. Yeah, of course.
All right.
Thank you, Terry. Hello?
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from...
Terry Robinson.
An inmate at Central Prison. This call will be monitored and recorded. To accept this call, press 5 now. Thank you for using Global Tel Link.
Okay, I'm back.
Hi, Terry. Yeah, thanks. Terry, can you tell me a little bit about the circumstances and surrounding how you found yourself on death row? How were you accused and prosecuted for a crime that you didn't commit?
So, first it started with a friend of mine who was really close. He was a neighbor, a guy that I had spent a lot of time with, practically raised. We weren't the best of friends. He was younger, so we didn't hang in the same social group. But he was a guy that was really close to me and was later determined that he was one of two suspects who had entered into a restaurant and demanded money. And there was a confrontation that took place between a manager whose name was John and one of the suspects, in which the manager was killed. And myself, because I was seen with this friend some time earlier in the day, and then I was seen in by witnesses later that night. Well, first of all, my friend dropped me off at my girlfriend's house, so I had every reason to be in the area, and the restaurant happened to be in the neighborhood. But because I was seen in the vicinity, in the area, the neighborhood later that night, there was enough probable cause for them to serve a warrant. And next thing I know, I was arrested at a cousin's house. Then I went to the interrogation room, and there was just all these things coming at me at once, and I just remember feeling lost. Like, there was this point where I just was so helpless, I just didn't know what to do. And so from that point on, I think I entered a state of helplessness, where I was just kind of a byproduct of all the things that were happening. You know, I went to jail, I did some probation time, and went to prison. When I came back 11 months later, my trial took place. And it was my jury selection lasted a day. The opening arguments lasted a day, and then the closing arguments lasted a day. So my trial lasted all of 3 days, and I was convicted. You know, I was convicted on testimony by a relative. I was convicted on testimony by a close friend. And I was convicted on circumstantial evidence. But what I was not convicted on was science and facts. And just my word alone, I know that criminals in that situation, I know that there's a stigma on innocence, that you expect the person to say, well, I didn't do it. It wasn't me. So I didn't really expect my word, my credibility to have a lot of weight in that situation. But I had been claiming my innocence from the very jump, from the beginning. And it was like I just wasn't, I wasn't even expecting to be believed, but I wasn't believed. And I remember the moment when the verdict came back and they said guilty. And my world just kind of shut down. Everything about me, who I was, my past, everything was just erased. And I was just in this moment. And it just felt like condemnation. It felt like I was doomed, you know. And from that point on, I went through my sentencing phase. By the time they got to the verdict of death, I was just so far removed from this world that it kind of didn't matter. I was just kind of swaddled up in this hurt, swaddled up in this pain. And it was enough of an injustice alone that they had found me guilty. So it kind of didn't matter after that point. And then after that, I found myself on death row. And that was 21 years ago.
Terry, how old were you when this happened? How old were you when you were convicted?
I was 25 years old.
Had you had any prior experience with the legal system?
I had been before a judge. I had been on trial. There's this historical repetitiveness in courts where, I don't know if a lot of people in society realize it, but the goal is to sustain convictions, you know, and there's these deals worked out here and there. And a lot of people, the plea bargain system, it allows criminals, it's like a pat in the back system, you know. A person can go out and do this crime, and then because they want to avoid trials and avoid paying taxpayers' money, then they let them off on these, with these slap on the wrist type of plea bargain. So my first crime happened when I was 15, and I was driving a friend's car, his mom's car, that he had stolen. I didn't have any license, and I was driving down the highway with no headlights. So I was pulled over, and I was charged. That was a juvenile case, and I received probation. I didn't go before a judge because it was all worked out on paper. Then at 17, there was a conversation that my brother and a friend of mine had with some guys. The friction really started a few days before then, where these guys, they instigated. It was white guys, and they, my friend and I was fishing, and they were throwing rocks at us while we were fishing. We hadn't done anything. They were just throwing rocks at us. So a few nights later, we saw them at a store. It was late night. We wanted to confront them. There was a gun involved. It was more for show. You know, there was no robbery or anything. We just wanted to fight. There was a grown man with them. We didn't know how to fight them and avenge ourselves for an act that they had committed against us without approaching and addressing this grown man. So the gun was simply to kind of hold him at bay while we get to this fighting soiree with these kids. And then that led to a charge of four armed robberies and a weapon of mass destruction. And again, I pled guilty, and it was dropped to two common law robberies, and I served about 2 years and 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another incident where I was accused of, in my opinion, probably a crime even more heinous than the one that's... There's no value that you can place on a person's life. There's no crime more heinous than the taking of a person's life. But when you are falsely accused of a crime, it all feels the same. And there was an incident in 1995 involving my daughter where these allegations were made. The charge ended up being a third-degree child abuse. I mean, it could have been a fifth-degree, 18th-degree, wouldn't have mattered when you are in it, you know, but it was all for the purpose of letting me off with a slap on the wrist, signing a plea bargain, and I eventually went to prison for another 2 years for a crime I didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
So I know how outlandish it sounds that a person can say in their life that they've been wrongfully convicted twice, but you are talking to if not the one person in the world who has certainly been wrongfully convicted on two occasions.
I'm sure there's more. Yeah. So Terry, when you mentioned in your trial, by the way, this is KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Terry Robinson, an innocent man who's on death row in North Carolina, and he's been on death row for 21 years. Terry, was your case picked up by the Innocence Project? Did we talk about that before?
I don't know if we talked about it before, but I did reach out to some few organizations when I first arrived, and there was one that had, this was really early on in the process in my incarceration, and there was one organization that had reached out to me, and to me that kind of set the tone for the rest of my incarceration. It left me deflated. There was hope at that point. It just kind of, it was gone after this. And it was the Cardozo School of Law, and they were very courteous with their response, and I think they certainly reviewed my case. They just couldn't help their response was that they specialize in DNA evidence, and in my case there was DNA evidence that it was already collected and processed, and the findings were delivered to a jury. The jury already heard that this DNA was didn't match, and they still, because of hearsay testimony, because of word of mouth testimony, the jury still decided to find me guilty. So their take on things where there's nothing we can do with evidence that already came back that excludes you from the crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, I was really deflated. You know, I figured that was my one shot. And some of the other innocence projects, I didn't meet the criteria. A lot of them, almost all of them, they had, and I guess I get it, you just don't want to take on cases and put all this resource into a case to find out that person is guilty. You know, so there is a criteria that you had to meet. One of them was that you couldn't have legal representation. Well, everyone on death row has legal representation because our appeals are in process. And when we don't have appeals, we don't have legal representation, then it means we're at the last of our appeals, which means the next stage is an execution date. So we all have legal representation, and I couldn't just get rid of my legal representation to meet the criteria. And then another criteria, which was even more strenuous than that, was you had to be in the last stages of your appeal. A lot of people here on death row are kind of stuck in limbo when it comes to appeal. We get to the MAR stage of our appeal, and then things just kind of stall. Even for my case, I've been on my MAR since 2002, so almost 19 years of it. I'm not hearing anything. So those two criteria I wasn't able to meet, and that kind of stopped me from reaching out to other innocence projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in your case, you said that what happened to the person who fingered you, the person who committed the crime? And so why did he say that you were an accomplice? Did he get a reduced sentence because of that?
Well, certainly that is enough, especially in the interrogation room. A lot of people don't realize that the psychological warfare. Like, these guys are trained to break you or crack you. You know, there's people who've been on death row who have admitted to crimes they didn't commit. It's been proven that they didn't commit. All because they lost the ward in the interrogation room. You know, so here's this guy who's 18 years old, and he finds himself in this horrendous position, you know, the situation, and these guys are promising him that we'll help you do all we can if you keep us this. And so I think that it was certainly a thing with him being promised a reduced sentence, and he certainly received one. I don't know the numbers, the specifics of his conviction, but I do know that he served about 11 or 12 years, and now he's home. He's been home for almost 10 years now.
So he was the person who was originally involved in this murder, and he's at home, and you're in death row, even though you are innocent.
Correct.
Do you know if he had an accomplice? Did he have an accomplice who is still free? Do you suspect he had an accomplice?
Certainly, the other person that was with him. It was only recorded that there was two accomplices. There's evidence. There's physical evidence that is suggesting that it may not be the case, that it could have possibly been more. We can't really know. So those are the things that we're just finding out. There's a lot of things about my case that I'm just finding out after 21 years.
Yeah.
Statements that people made that I could have used in my defense. You know, so there's certainly evidence that there were two accomplices. All the witnesses and bystanders are witness to accomplices. And he was arrested, and then I was arrested, so there certainly has to be an accomplice out there who was never brought to justice.
Yeah, well, and you were talking about how what it's like when you're brought into questioning, and how in the interrogation room it's like psychological warfare. Did that happen to you as well?
I mean, it did. I think at the point though, so the judicial system and I'm sure there are some who would argue that it's still the same. It used to be an instrument for justice, you know. I mean, it was a tool to kind of invoke safety into the citizens and the civilians, let them know that people won't just commit crimes and get away with it. The judicial system is here. We are the valiant institution, and we'll make people pay for their wrong. But all in all, the judicial system is a industry, you know. It's a business, and guilt is a brain. Like, people want to buy so much into people's guilt, and no one wants to believe a person is innocent in prison. They quickly shun the person who says he's innocent without even giving him a moment.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
To believe that there is a judicial system that would put a man away. And so, for my case, I was the easier conviction. I had a criminal past. This other guy didn't. I was seen in the area by witnesses. Other guy, I've admitted to being in the area, but never said it. So I was the easier conviction. So they were using his aid and his assistance to elicit a conviction. Conviction.
Thank you.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Are you able to call me back this morning still?
I am.
Okay,
I am.
Great.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Terry Robinson,
an inmate at Central Prison.
Thank you. This is KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Terry Robinson. He is an innocent man on death row in North Carolina. And we're talking about generalities around his case, his life prior to being sent to death row, and hopefully how he will come off of death row and, you know, receive a like what he deserves, which is innocence and compensation. So Terry, you were telling, we were talking before about interrogation and the person who committed the crime and also accused you of being part of it. You mentioned in your trial that your conviction was based on hearsay testimony from two witnesses, as well as the person who was originally convicted of the crime, and one of them was a family member. Can you talk a little bit about the two witnesses that offered hearsay testimony? Why did they do it? What was their motivation, if you know?
So one of the witnesses was a civilian, you know. She was a girlfriend of a friend of mine, and this guy who was a friend, we hadn't been friends long, but he was a guy I'd met in the county jail some 3 months before the incident. Landon stayed in jail a short while. He stayed even shorter than that, so he was released a few days before I was, and we kind of made this plan to, when we got out of jail, we would kind of hook up. And so I went to his house once or twice. We played video games, we drank beer. We did what we, because we both were into those things at that time, you know. But I gathered really quick that he was like a family guy. I met him at his house. You know, he had a girlfriend and a newborn baby. He worked every day. And I was on the streets every night. Like, I carried drugs. I'm about boxing, those type of things. So we ran in two different circles, you know. So he wasn't like a guy whose house I hung at often, but this night I was walking back to my girlfriend's house, some 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, approximately an hour after the crime had taken place. And because the neighborhood was swarming with police, I was looking for a diversion. You know, I was really nervous about, I didn't know what I was walking into. I was headed towards her house, and again, the location of the crime scene was right across the street from her house. So the closer I got, the more activity I saw buzzing around the neighborhood. So I ended up at my friend's house as just this ploy to try to throw off the surveilling the cops, you know, though they kept zooming by and kind of paying attention, taking notice to everyone. And I ended up at his doorstep, and he opened the door. He and I had an exchange, and I think I stayed up maybe 10 minutes and I left. Well, the next day, he mentioned it to a coworker. My coworker heard some things that he gathered were suspicious, called the police, and that's how the police got involved. And then they showed up at his job, questioned him about my arrival the night before. And then when they went to talk to his girlfriend, she had a different version of how I showed up. And from her explanation of my arrival, it provoked the authorities to go back and do a lineup. And so from the very beginning, I was a suspect. I was the top suspect. This was long before any call to Crime Stoppers, long before the second suspect's admission, before the arrest. I was already like one of their prime suspects. And then I think from then it just made a case. So one of the witnesses was this girlfriend who showed up, and she discussed my behavior and my demeanor the night I showed up at their house. Yeah. And it kind of led to the credibility of me showing up frantic and all those things. And then another witness was a relative of mine. He was actually my first cousin. He's the first cousin of mine. And his testimony was that I showed up at his house and admitted to him that I was the perpetrator.
Why did your cousin say that?
Initially, we thought that, I don't really know how true or not true it is, but initially it was determined by the family that he was being surreptitious and being anonymous and it was out for reward money. You know, this family member didn't have the best reputation in the past, you know. I mean, my family, I love him, so I won't drag his name through the mud. I can only speak the truth. He didn't have the best reputation in the family. So initially we thought it could have been solely about trying to gather some reward money. And it wasn't until later that we realized now that there could possibly be some involvement by his first cousin, and this was actually an attempt to throw off the car from his involvement, you know. Okay. So that's still to be determined.
Yeah. It sounds, I mean, from what you're describing a situation in which the police use tactics of intimidation, bullying, lying, deception, and manipulation in order to try to get suspects, try to intimidate potential witnesses, and, use the community resources, which are based on trust and are based on cooperation against the community, in order to like pull out someone as a suspect or as someone to be identified as the person who's gonna get fingered for the crime. Does that sound at all accurate to your experience?
It is, absolutely. I mean, a lot of times the people in town and the people in the city, they don't realize how they indirectly lend themselves to wrongful conviction. You know, but it's all about conviction and it's about results. And as long as the DA is producing results, then they get votes, you know. The families and the citizens feel safe. So I was the safe bet, you know. I was how people were able to sleep at night, mm-hmm. knowing that from their perspective, this man killed this innocent man who was working. He deserves to die. That's in the death row.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that was the case, I would make a pitch against death row, because a lot of my stay here has been to not only I haven't promoted my innocence. I haven't went on this campaign of innocence because a lot of people don't understand the difficulties with that, being in prison around people, especially hardened killers, and then admitting this weakness that, I don't deserve to be here. I didn't kill anyone.
So, Terry, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us on Prison Pipeline. It's just been so informative, and I really wish you the best with your case moving forward.
It's your work that's going to make the difference. It's going to make the change. So thank you for the opportunity.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people.